Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today begins a series on the teleological argument for God. We begin with part one. For many more resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Most folks have thought, or the conventional wisdom is, that the argument from design really was destroyed by Darwin and his biological theory of evolution and the critiques of skeptics like David Hume. But in recent years, this argument has come roaring back into center stage because of the discovery that the initial conditions of the universe, given in the Big Bang itself, had to be fine-tuned to an incomprehensible precision in order to permit the evolution and existence of intelligent life like Homo sapiens, like ours. In fact, for intelligent life of comparable ability to ourselves to exist anywhere else in the known cosmos, anywhere in the universe, you had to have this elaborately set table in advance in these highly specified conditions in the Big Bang. And so what's happened is that the design argument has sort of done an end run around Darwin and gone back to the very beginning of the universe and discovered that even in order for evolution to take place, in order for Homo sapiens to evolve, you had to have this incredibly complex, delicately balanced system in place already right at the beginning. So that even given the fact of biological evolution, you can't escape the necessity of divine design and some kind of a cosmic intelligence. So just in terms of strategy, this argument, I think, is extremely powerful because it just, as I say, completely avoids that hot potato of Darwinian biological evolution. You don't have to run up against all of the social and emotional baggage that goes with trying to go against the Scopes monkey trial or introduce creationism in the schools or anything of that sort. You can just completely do an end run around that by going right back to the fine-tuning of the universe. And if that requires a designer to even get the thing started, then the additional need for design for the origin of life or the origin of mind or the origin of biological complexity simply adds layer after layer after layer of design on top of the initial design that you've demonstrated right in the initial conditions of the universe. It just shows that for this to have happened by chance alone, you have improbability piled on improbability piled on improbability. And so it will only strengthen your argument. And so what we want to do in this argument is look at the teleological argument, or the argument from design, based on the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. And as you can see on your outline there, it can be reduced to three very simple steps. Number one, the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe is due to either law, chance, or design. Number two says it is not due to law or chance. So you eliminate two of the alternatives. And then on the next page, three, therefore it is due to design. So basically you pose a kind of trilemma here, and then you eliminate two of the disjuncts, and that leaves you with the logically remaining alternative, namely intelligent design. Now, Hugh Ross will talk with you at length about the fine-tuning of the universe that actually exists. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the scientific information pertinent to fine-tuning, because this is where Hugh Ross will really ladle it on. But rather, what I think I can do as a philosopher is to set the philosophical framework in which this fine-tuning becomes significant by giving you the sort of logical argument that draws out the significance of the fine-tuning. Hugh will talk mainly about the nuts and bolts of science, but he won't talk much about the philosophical framework for this, and so that's what I want to do. Now, what do we mean, first of all, under premise one, by fine-tuning of the universe. This is not a question-begging term. It does not mean designed. When one says the universe is fine-tuned for intelligent life, you might think, well, if it's finely tuned, that requires a fine tuner. And so you've already built in the existence of an intelligence by the very label fine-tuning. But that's not what scientists mean by the word fine-tuning. It's not begging the question by defining fine-tuning to mean intelligently aimed at a particular goal. Rather, what is meant is there are really kind of two definitions of fine-tuning going on today. And I want to draw out the meaning of both of these so that you'll understand when Hugh gives examples of fine-tuning exactly what it is. Now, this fine-tuning, let me back up a second and say this fine-tuning consists of basically two sorts of quantity of the initial conditions of the universe. One would be certain constants of nature. And I'll put this one on the other board here too so you can see on the other side. Certain constants of nature. And then in addition to these constants, there are certain arbitrary quantities. Now let me give some examples of each of these. With respect to the constants of nature, when the laws of nature are expressed as mathematical equations, you find appearing in them certain constants which are the same across the board. Let me just give an example. Newton's law of gravity, where he calculates the gravitational force between two objects. Newton would say that the force, which we'll symbolize by F, is equal to a certain gravitational constant, G. So here we have the force equals this gravitational constant, G. And then suppose you want to figure out the gravitational attraction or force between the Earth and the Moon. Well, what you do is you take the mass of one of these bodies, say the Earth, and you multiply it times the mass of the other body, the Moon. So you have M1 would be the mass of the Earth, and M2 is the mass of the Moon. And then you take the distance between them squared, which we'll symbolize as R squared, and you divide that product of their masses by R squared. So that is the statement of Newton's law of gravitation. The gravitational force is this gravitational constant G times the mass of one object times the mass of the other object divided by the square of the distance between them. And obviously, these masses can vary. You might be thinking of an asteroid and the Earth, or you might be thinking of the Sun and Jupiter and so forth, and their distance will vary. But this G is a constant. You see, it stays the same, this gravitational constant. And this is what we're talking about when we talk about the constants in nature, are these certain factors that appear in the laws of nature in mathematical form that are invariable. Now, the interesting thing about these constants is that they're independent of the laws of nature. The laws of nature don't determine what the value of G is. G could have any of a wide range of values. It could have any of these values, and the law would still hold. It would still be true that the force, F, is equal to that constant times the product of the masses divided by the distance between them squared. So that the laws of nature don't determine the values of these constants. Now that's very important to understand, that there isn't any kind of natural necessity or law that determines why these constants have the values they do. So that's the first type of quantity that we're talking about, would be these constants in nature. Now the second type of quantity that we're talking about is these arbitrary quantities. Cindy?
You're not saying that gravity, G, is a constant and is the same no matter where you're using it?
I guess I'm lost.
It's constant because I think of gravity being greater the closer to the Earth.
Yeah, you're thinking of F here. That's what you're thinking of. That force, yeah, that will vary based upon how you fill in the values for this equation. But what I'm saying is that the G always has the same value, whether this is a rock and the moon or the sun and Jupiter or Saturn and Uranus, and no matter how close they are or far apart, that those things all vary, but the G will remain the same when you figure out, well, what is that real tug that we feel? Okay? So the laws of nature don't determine what these constants are. They just appear. You know, they're just sort of there. That's just the way the world is. It has these constants. Now, the other type of quantity is what I call arbitrary quantities, or we could call them boundary conditions or initial conditions. These would just be sort of arbitrary quantities that are put in at the beginning of the universe on which the laws of nature then operate. For example, remember we talked last week about the amount of entropy in the universe, and we said that according to the second law of thermodynamics, entropy is always increasing, always growing, as energy is diffused and as the universe comes to equilibrium. Well, what that means is that at the beginning of the universe, there was just sort of an arbitrary low entropy quantity put in as an initial condition. There isn't any law of nature, and it's not a constant of nature. It's just a sort of arbitrary quantity that's put in at the creation, and then the laws of nature, like the second law of thermodynamics, operates on this quantity. Or another example would be the ratio between matter and antimatter in the early universe. What quantities of those were put in? So you have constants of nature, and then you have arbitrary quantities or boundary or initial conditions that are just put in arbitrarily, and the universe or the laws of nature then operate on these. Now, what scientists have been stunned to discover in the last 30, 40 years is that these constants and quantities have to be fine-tuned to an incomprehensible precision in order for the universe to permit the evolution and existence of intelligent life. Once upon a time, scientists thought that whatever the initial conditions of the universe were, that eventually, given enough time, intelligent life like ours might evolve. But now we know that's false. In fact, our existence is balanced on a razor's edge of incomprehensible fineness and precision. If these constants or quantities were not fine-tuned for our existence, then the universe would be non-life permitting. It would be a life prohibiting universe rather than a life permitting universe. And Hugh Ross will describe some of these and show that if certain things like the force of gravity were to be altered just a little bit, or if there had been a different ratio of matter to antimatter in the universe, then the universe wouldn't even exist. It would just, there wouldn't be any matter even in many cases. There wouldn't even be chemistry. So that our existence hinges upon this finely tuned, complex array of constants and quantities just given in the Big Bang. Now, before I take a question, I was going to say before I launched into this that there are two ways in which we can understand the term fine-tuning. When we say these constants and quantities are finely tuned, there are two different ways in which this could be meant. Usually, what people mean is that if the quantity or constant were to be altered just a little bit either way, say it was a little more or it was a little less, then that would upset the life-permitting balance and life would be impossible. To give a couple of examples, P.C.W. Davies, a British physicist, has estimated that if you were to alter the force of gravity or the weak force, which is in the atomic nucleus, by only one part, Well, this pen here doesn't work so good. Let me get another. If you were to alter it by only one part out of 10 to the 100th power, the universe would be life-prohibiting. It would be impossible for the universe to permit life. Yeah, this is gravity or the weak force. Davy says, altered by even one part out of 10 to the 100th power, and the universe would be life-prohibiting. Now, to give you an idea of what these numbers are like, if you have something that is one chance out of 10 to the 60th power, which is inconceivably smaller than 10 to the 100th power, if you have something that is 10 to the 60th power, that would be like throwing a random dart across the universe 20 billion light years away and hitting a target 1 inch in diameter. That's what we're talking about when we say that these constants and quantities are fine-tuned for our existence. Imagine a random dart thrown 20 billion light years across the universe. It has to hit a target 1 inch in diameter in order for the universe to be life permitting if it were 10 to the 60th. But in fact, it's like 1 out of 10 to the 100th. And that's just one quantity. That's just gravity, or that's just the weak force. And you've got loads of these constants and quantities that all have to be precisely fine-tuned in that way, or the universe wouldn't be life prohibiting. And that's what Dr. Ross is going to talk about, I'm sure, and will amaze you by how finely tuned the universe is. Now, there's one other way, however, in which we can understand this fine-tuning. Let me just do this first, and then we'll take the questions. The other way is in which we could imagine the possible range of values that these quantities and constants might take, like that. Imagine this is the possible range of values. And then what you do is you calculate the life-permitting range that the value would have to fall in. And maybe the life-permitting range is, here's the life-permitting range. Now, you can see here that we're allowing, that there's a good deal of latitude here in the life-permitting range, that it could vary. It's not as though if you just varied it by one part out of 10 to the 100th, life wouldn't exist. No, there is a range of values that would be life-permitting. But nevertheless, when you compare the life-permitting range to the entire range of possible values, it's so small that the odds of this constant or quantity falling into the life-permitting range are next to infinitesimal. That if it were just by accident that it were to have the value it does, it would fall somewhere outside the life-permitting range. So, for example, Robin Collins has compared the fine-tuning of some of these constants and quantities to a radio dial, like before they had the digital radios that you used to have to tune the knob and line it up to be right on the bandwidth that you'd get the clear station. He said for you to dial in the station that would permit life to exist in the universe would be like having a radio dial that would be the breadth of the entire known universe. And you would have to dial into about 2.5 centimeters in order to get into the life-permitting range. Now, just think of that. If these constants and quantities just fell into this range, the odds are astronomically more probable that it would fall somewhere outside of that narrow life-permitting range. If it were just by accident, they wouldn't all of them fall into those narrow life-permitting ranges. So that's two senses in which scientists speak of fine-tuning, and they don't always keep it clear which sense they're talking about. The one sense is you just consider the actual value the constant or quantity has, and you show that if it were altered slightly one way or the other, the universe would not be life-permitting. The other way is to consider the life-permitting range of a quantity compared to the range of possible values, and you show that it's so infinitesimally small that the odds of it happening by chance alone are incalculably small, vanishingly small, in fact. So That's what is meant by fine-tuning, and you can see that so understood, it's not a question-begging term. Rather, it's simply saying that in order for intelligent life to exist, these quantities and constants have to have very precise values, or they have to fall into extraordinarily narrow ranges of values, or otherwise the universe would not permit life. Yes?
How many constants are there?
I'm not sure how many do you know.
There are probably about a dozen basic fundamental constants, and the rest are derived from those.
Yeah, okay.
The most basic ones are not, by definition. There are some other constants that you can derive from the more fundamental ones. We call them fundamental constants, and those are not related to each other, at least so far as we know. And there's probably roughly a dozen of those.
This is an interesting question because it does raise the issue of whether we could find a kind of unified theory that would explain how some of the constants might fall out from a super force or a theory of everything that some people might hope would eliminate all of these independent constants. But so far, that has eluded grasp. I'll say something more about that later on as well. Okay, other comprehension type questions. Scotty?
Two. We agree that the narrowness has allowed life as we know it, but this life is not over. This universe is not over. So we're saying that this narrowness allows life for a moment, for eternity minus one, or what? So maybe this isn't... This fine-tuning is not as fine-tuned as it needs to be. Maybe we will perish in the not-too-cosmological... second part. We said last week that the possibilities of unlimited universes. It is possible. There are multiple universes. And we are arguing with people who we claim that there was a cause to our universe. We're arguing with people who are saying that there were causes other than what we call these causes. We could reach this point of fine-tuning if we use, I don't want to use the term infinity because I got caught on that a couple weeks ago, but an unlimited number of universes.
All right.
Being created and being destroyed. And
perfect.
Where are we, like I said,
right.
Where are we on the line of infinity?
You're thinking way ahead of us here. You're way ahead of the curve.
I'm not thinking way ahead. I'm terribly confused.
No. This is where the debate lies today, Scotty, really. This idea of the multiple universe hypothesis, or what I call a world ensemble. And if you'll look at 2.14 on the second part of your outline, you'll see that we're going to get to that, and that this is the main way in which detractors of intelligent design try to escape the need for a divine designer of the cosmos, is by positing a world ensemble of invisible, undetectable, parallel universes. And we'll see how they attempt to elude design. So hang on to that. We'll get to it. Now, with respect to the first question, fine-tuning would just mean for the existence of intelligent life at all, at any time in the cosmos. Eventually, as you point out, if Christ doesn't return, life would all perish in the heat death of the universe anyway. But for the universe to permit the evolution and intelligent life anywhere, on any planet, anywhere in the known cosmos, it's all going to be based on the fine-tuning of the initial conditions that were present in the Big Bang itself.
Can I ask you one more thing that I think I couldn't catch up with?
Okay.
You said that arbitrary quantities in the constants. Well, you're saying at the creation of the universe that some of these constants simply were a product of that particular experiment in building that universe.
Well, if you put it that way, yeah. That we
had more gold than we had hydrogen, and that universe would not function because that didn't develop the arbitrary quantities that we needed to arrive at the constants.
No, I wasn't saying that. These are independent of each other. The constants are not determined by the arbitrary quantities. These are independent of each other. So these are two examples of things that need to be fine-tuned. The constants of nature And as we indicated in answer to this question in David's comment, folks are still trying to explain how you could explain the constants, why they have the values they do. And then there's these arbitrary quantities that are not law-like. They're just what are called initial conditions. Okay, let me take a question from somebody else. Yes, Michael.
Just a point of clarification. And I don't necessarily know where I'm going with this, but when you talk about life prohibiting or life permitting, they mean, I guess, life as we know it? I mean, like as a human,
yeah,
as opposed to some, you know, alien picture thing?
Or yeah. Yes, this is a question that's always asked. It always comes up, and so I think it would be a good to address it here. What biologists mean by life is the ability of an organism to extract energy from its environment, process that energy so as to reproduce and to beget after its kind. That's basically what you mean by life. And the suggestion here is that without these constants and quantities being finely tuned, you wouldn't have that anywhere in the universe. So this is quite consistent with imagining forms of life that are very different from what we see here on Earth. Maybe, I don't know, jelly-like globs with, you know, alien beings and things of this sort. That's quite consistent with that. But that general definition of life requires this kind of fine-tuning of the constants and quantities in order to exist. Now, somebody might say, well, but what about a universe that was governed by totally different laws of nature? Not these laws of nature, but just totally different laws of nature. Then maybe you could have life exist that wouldn't require the fine-tuning of the constants and quantities. And we don't have to argue about that. We can say, yeah, that's possible if you want to think about universes that have totally different laws of nature. But those are not relevant to this argument because we are talking only about universes that are governed by our laws of nature. And let me give you an example of how this works. John Barrow, who is a professor of physics at Cambridge University, says that we can get a picture of the fine-tuning by doing this experiment. He says, let's take a big blank piece of paper like this whiteboard, and let's put a red dot on it. And that red dot represents our universe. Now, he says, let's change some of these constants and quantities by these fractional amounts, and that will give you a new universe. And if that universe is life-permitting, make it a red dot, and if it's life-prohibiting, he says make it a blue dot, but since blue doesn't work, I'll make it a green dot. And then do that again, do it again, do it again, do it again, do it again, and so forth, until your board is completely filled with dots. And what you find out when you're done is that you will have a sea of green with only a few pinpricks of red here or there. So that any universe within this sheet, so to speak, that is created by accident, by chance alone, it would be vastly more probable that it would be a green universe rather than a red one. Now, to say, well, what about universes that are governed by different laws? That's to consider universes that aren't even on the sheet. That's you know universes that are way out here somewhere off the wall, because you're not even talking about the same laws of nature. And even if you could have life existing in those universes, the fact is that within our local group of possible universes, any randomly thrown dart that hits the board is going to hit a green one rather than a red one, even if a randomly thrown dart over here might be apt to hit a red one rather than a green one. We're concerned with the local probability here. John Leslie, who is a philosopher who has dealt most extensively with these considerations, gives this illustration that I think makes it very clear. He says, imagine a fly resting on a large blank area of the wall, and a random bullet is fired, and the bullet hits the fly exactly and pierces the fly. Now, he says, even if outside of the large blank area, the wall was covered with flies, so that a randomly fired bullet would likely hit one. Nevertheless, you would conclude that the bullet that does actually hit the fly is aimed, not randomly fired, because if it were randomly fired within that large blank area, it would be more likely to hit a blank spot than the single spot occupied by the fly. So we don't have to deny the possibility that were there other universes with other laws of nature, life might evolve in them. The fact remains that in a universe governed by the laws of nature that do exist, in order for life, as I defined it, to exist anywhere in those kind of universes, you've got to have this kind of fine-tuning. You want to follow up?
So basically what you're saying is we don't have to prove that every possible combination, you know, would have been created. We just have to work with our universe
right.
And say that our universe has been created.
Well, not even with our universe. I want to make it bigger than that. Think of our board here. It's just with any universe governed by the same laws that govern our universe. So these are different universes because we're changing these constants and we're changing these quantities when we do this. So they're different universes, but they're all governed by the same laws. It's variations of the constants and quantities within the parameters of the laws of nature. And that's all that the argument needs to consider. It doesn't need to speculate about, well, suppose there were different laws of nature. You know, that just doesn't come into the issue. Yes, Robert.
The comment you used on the razor's edge is extremely liberal. Because what you're talking about would be more like on a strand of quarks.
Yeah.
In other words, it's beyond human comprehension. Yeah. It's like the razor's line of divine will that is so, these numbers you're talking about are just...
Yeah, he's actually right. I use the term razor's edge because it's an idiom, but a razor's edge, when you're talking about this, that would be like a big flat plane, the razor's edge, compared to the fineness of the tuning that we're talking about here. It really is incomprehensible. You can't really understand it. It's so fine. Yes, Cindy.
Again, given this apparent obvious existence or reality, how do the atheistic scientists argue that beyond all of this probability, it did just happen?
All right, well, that segues into our alternatives, right? Wait, Scotty. Now, some will still want to deny the fact of fine-tuning. They'll say
it's not really like you just...
Yeah, they'll say what you said is not really right. It's not really finely tuned. But those voices are becoming quite minority voices now, I think, because we have very solid evidence for fine-tuning, and this is what I'm leaving for Hugh Ross to discuss when he gets here. I've heard him lecture on it before.
What you're describing is an opinion. For example, you mentioned this gravity issue.
Yeah.
How it would have to be. And that is a mathematical assumption. We don't have a way to prove, if you will, that if the gravity was altered one bit, then none of this would happen, or is there any...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We do. These are, I think, quite firmly established instances of fine-tuning. That, for example, if you were to increase gravity a significant amount, then the universe would have re-collapsed into a hot fireball billions and trillions of degrees, and there wouldn't be any life possible. Or if gravity were too small, the universe would just expand forever and it would never coagulate into galaxies and stars, so there would never be any places for life to exist. So these are demonstrable examples, scientifically, of fine-tuning. And that's why I say those who want to deny fine-tuning are becoming, I think, minority voices, because the examples of fine-tuning seem to be very firmly established and probably aren't going to go away. Yes, way in the back here.
I saw something on television. Our scientists have been studying these rocks, you know, near a volcano for such a long time that it shows that, or at least from their reports, that gravity had flipped a few times while the Earth's existed, while these volcanic rocks have been there.
That one I can say something about. It's not actually gravity that's changed, it's just the Earth's magnetic field oscillates every few thousand years. So gravity is very firmly established.
Okay, good. Thank you. Now, let me see if there's somebody else. Okay, yeah.
Almost an aside, but in the pursuit of what we're studying, if we were to study this, which would take a long time, are we moving toward, or do you conclude, do your beliefs conclude that there is only one universe, that multiple universes is against the design of God?
Oh, well, you're really jumping the gun here again, because right, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that, but let's not rush into.
I'll lay out in the hall with 7-year-olds.
Yeah, let's not rush into that, because that's sort of the crowning issue, you know, and to talk about that now would make everything else look anticlimactic. So we'll get to the many worlds hypothesis. We will, I promise. All right. So the first premise basically states that there are three possible ways of explaining this fine-tuning. And this gets back to Cindy's question. Once you do concede, yeah, it looks like these requisite conditions for intelligent life are extraordinarily narrow and sensitive, you're basically left with three explanations: law, chance, or intelligent design. Now, the first alternative, law, would be to say there's some unknown law of nature that would determine the value of these constants. Maybe, as we said, there's a theory of everything that would show that the constants had to have the values that they had, or at least pretty near that. And so it's not really arbitrary or chance, it's necessary. So this is not a chance explanation. It's saying there's a kind of physical necessity that makes the constants and the quantities have the values that they do. That would be the first alternative. The second alternative would be the chance hypothesis, that this is just an extraordinarily lucky accident and that we're just the lucky beneficiaries of this extraordinary improbability. And then the third alternative would reject both of those in favor of saying that the reason that the universe looks fine-tuned is because it is fine-tuned. It has been designed by an intelligence for the existence of intelligent life like ourselves. Yes?
In saying that, there's nothing in that would preclude there being within the universe other life.
Right.
Whether like our life or not like our life.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think the intelligent design theorist is very open to the idea that the designer may have created other planets with life on them, with maybe comparable intelligence or greater than ourselves. So this says nothing about whether there are life on other planets. That would be more relevant to theories of biological evolution, perhaps. How probable is it, given these initial conditions, that life would evolve? And I think that if one were to get into that discussion, what you would find out is that even given these finely tuned constants and quantities, the chances that it would evolve biological complexity of the sort that we see on this planet is extraordinarily improbable. But that's here, neither here nor there now. That would simply be to strengthen the argument by layering on more improbability. Yes?
I was going to say, it seems to me if we were to discover a life on another planet, that would even be more probable than it to be inside. What you're saying is you doubled again the improbability of life here. It's been done somewhere else. Again, by chance.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I don't know how to respond to that. But that would be a good question to ask Hugh Ross. I mean,
all I was saying is, if everyone agrees that the conditions would have to be so fine-tuned to permit life as we see,
yeah, Oh, I see.
We would discover life elsewhere.
Okay.
To me, is more evidence of a designer.
I think in that case, Cindy, what you would need to show is that the conditions for a planet to be life-permitting are extraordinarily improbable. And then to see that happen multiple times, that would increase the improbability. But I'm not talking here about the improbability of this planet existing. That's a whole different fine-tuning argument, and Ross may talk about that as well. Notice when he'll talk about these cosmological fine-tuning examples, but then he'll probably also talk about what we could call terrestrial fine-tuning, about the atmosphere of the Earth, the distance of the Earth from its star, the mass of the Earth, the presence of having a single moon. All of these things also contribute to making the Earth incredibly fine-tuned. But I'm abstracting from that altogether. That would only strengthen my argument if you lay all of that improbability on. But we're just confining ourselves, at least today, to this cosmological fine-tuning. But I'm sure that Dr. Ross will also talk about what we could call terrestrial fine-tuning as well. Now, we're out of time, and I need to respect your time, so we'll terminate it there, but come back next week, and I'm sure you'll hear a fascinating lecture on the fine-tuning. So thank you all, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.